Hello, welcome to another episode of Unpacking Neuroqueerness. Today I have another special guest on the podcast, Matt Lowry from the Autistic Culture podcast. I'm going to talk a little bit with Matt today about his work as an LLP and then also raising an autistic child and also his podcast. Variety of different things. So anyways, without further ado, welcome Matt.
Hi, good to meet you. Good to be here.
Nice to meet you as well. Thank you for coming on. So I wanted to start out, the first question I wanted to ask you today is, when did you discover that you are autistic, and what has the journey of unmasking and like also navigating this neurotypical society been like for you?
Oh God. Okay. So this is going to be a long one. My story is long and weird. It started off when I was actually in first grade. And I don't remember this, but the way that it was told was that my first grade teacher said, "Hey, maybe we should give him a test and see how he does things." And it was after school, and I apparently freaked out because I was afraid of being locked in the school forever. So I ran out of the building screaming, and they said, "Well, we'll try it again." And I had my same teacher for third grade because she changed. And she said, "Well, let's try that test again and see, you know, how he does things during school so he won't be afraid that he'll be locked in." So after this test, I was all of a sudden put in gifted classes, and this psychologist started following me around, asking me to do stuff like, you know, do puzzles and have conversations and build Legos and all this other stuff. But I didn't find out until years later. I was working in the physiology department at UK when I was 14, and one of the grad students came in and he was like, "Did you know you have Asperger's?" And I was like, "No, what's that?" And after a while, I ended up working in the autism lab. And it turns out that the guy who followed me around was the guy who ran the autism lab. And all those times where I was like doing like building Legos and having tests, it was part of a big study about gifted autistic kids. So I was like, "Oh, okay." So I started working in the autism lab and studying autistic kids and studying autism. And like it was just a very natural thing for me because it was like, "Oh, these are my people. This explains many things." But I went back into the closet when I was in grad school because, you know, there was a lot of bias among the practitioners and practitioners to be about autism. And there was one time where my cultural professor got mad when I tried to say that, you know, this is a culture. And she's like, "No, that's just being nerdy." And I'm like, "All right." And when I went into work in community mental health, I of course gravitated towards the autistic kids. I worked as a school-based therapist doing therapy in the schools, and I got all the autistic kids. At the time, it was 2008, and I identified as Aspie before we found out how horrible Hans Asperger's was. Yeah. But I identified as Aspie, and I had my Aspie groups, and I told my supervisor, asked how I was doing. I was like, "Yeah, the Aspie groups are going great." She said, "Matt, you can't use that word." It's like, "Which word?" "Aspie." I was like, "Well, that's how I identify because I have the Asperger's there." And she said, "Matt, you can't say that. It's like," and she said that it was like me calling myself the R word. So I was like, "Oh, I just won't ever tell you anything else ever again. Thank you." So I hid my, well, I'm clearly autistic, but I hid and masked as best I could for many, many years. I eventually met the mother of my child, my autistic child. She's neurotypical, and I was like, "Yeah, I can handle all this," until finally, you know, my son was born about 3 months early and needed the NICU, and I just hit burnout so hard, and I couldn't mask anymore, and it ended up having trouble at work. And long story short, I ended up making my own practice where I focused on autistic people. And I didn't know I was going to find as many autistic adults as I did. So I named my business Child and Adolescent Psychological Evaluations just for the Google hits. I ended up finding a lot of autistic people and by proxy, a lot of autistic adults. And that's when I started doing the podcast, and we built the autism center that's run exclusively by autistic people. It's trailhouse.org, and here we are today. And it's I'm much better off today than I was, but God, the masking periods were rough because the dealing with the holistics and having to mask and pretend to be something that I'm not. Was a killer.
Yeah, and I certainly relate to that experience of like even before I knew that I was autistic, I feel like I was masking every day, just like, not stimming and like forcing eye contact, and also just like every conversation and every interaction, like hyper analyzing and studying it, and then worrying about how I'm being perceived, and then feeling like often because of the di like differences in my tone or whatnot, I was like I feel like misunderstandings would happen a lot.
There was one time at work when I left a meeting early to go do something or other, and apparently one of the coworkers hijacked the meeting to talk about how weird I was because I, quote, used big words and nobody knew what I was talking about. And this is the same person. There was a very, very clear moment one time when I was sitting there doing my notes, and there was a conversation with three women sitting around the table. And one of them says, "Babies are cute. Babies are cute. Babies are cute. Babies are small. Babies are small. Babies are small. Babies smell good." And they just kept this going around in a circle, making statements of fact and echoing it with different intonations. And that was a moment when I realized, oh my God, I have absolutely no idea how the humans work. Because, like, that's not how I can do things. I can't bring myself to have that weirdness there. If I'm going to have something to say, I want to have something, substantial to say. It's. I can't do that. And that's the big reason why I was vilified, because I didn't fit in. I didn't just echo what other people said.
Yeah, and it's like the whole, I mean, there's a lot like the small talk game. That's definitely something I've always just not done well with, and
They love talking about the days of the week. Like, well,
yeah.
it's a case of the Mondays. Thank
Yeah.
God it's Friday. It's hump day. They love stating what day of the week it is, and they just repeating it. And I don't understand why. It's fascinating.
Yeah, and then, well, something that's interesting that happens for me is that I happen to have a special interest in weather, and
The weather is weather today.
neurotypical. And
Yes.
then so all like it's funny because I know neurotypicals use it as small talk, and then they don't expect it. I'm gonna start info dumping on it,
Yeah, because you get to like the jet streams and the pop-up showers and the
exactly.
dew point and all the and, but that's the thing. The weather is the originator of chaos theory because of all the infinite variables that go into, doing this, but they don't like to talk about any of that.
They don't. It's fun. They want like, oh yeah, it's cold today. It's gonna rain today, or but then I'll like, okay, but this is why, because of the jet stream coming in here and the cold front and the rain and the condensation and the frost, and then they're just lost. Like after 30 seconds, they're just, yeah, they're done. And then they also and they show like. I value direct. I mean, I know a lot of us value direct communication in the autistic world,
Of
and I
course.
know that like neurotypicals don't like it, and they feel like they can't do it either. And then there's this complex that happens where like they get tired of what you're saying, but they don't tell you. And then like, okay, I'm not supposed to know. Like, you didn't tell me, so I'm gonna keep going. And then they're upset because you didn't know, because they didn't tell you. I don't know. There's a lot of
Yeah, because
stuff.
we should just know things instead of being reliant upon them to actively communicate. Yeah, it's a weird world out there.
It's very
I
weird.
just you know, and that's the thing. I've always been an outsider to it, and until I found the autistic community, it was always baffling. I never really I thought I was just bad at peopling. But it's just neurotypicals. I just I don't understand the neurotypical world, and I don't understand neurotypical culture. Autistic culture, I'm all about, but neurotypical culture just baffles me.
Me too. And still to this day, is baffling. And I think especially as I've started to communicate, to connect more with the autistic community, online and through podcasting. And I get used to hanging out in autistic circles, and then I go into neurotypical circles and I'm like, oh my goodness,
Yeah,
this
that's the thing there, because I've gotten so comfortable existing solely in an autistic sphere, at where you say, "Hey, is this weird? Oh my God, that's so weird. Anybody else have problems with socks? Of course we do." And then you go into the neurotypical space, and it's just a culture shock after that, and you're like, "Oh my God, what's up with these people? Why do they keep staring at my eyeballs?"
I know,
And yeah,
yeah.
it's just it's fascinating. And my main job is doing autism evaluations from an autistic affirming point of view, right? And instead of going by the DSM and talking about how socially awkward we are, I talk about interoception, proprioception, exteroception, all the stuff that really makes us who we are. I talk about medical history, because we have wonky meat bodies and all this other stuff. And every once in a while, a neurotypical will somehow get through and come in for an evaluation. And it reminds me how very, very differently, because again, when I meet autistic people, we'll talk for hours about how we forget to eat and forget to go to the bathroom and, have incredible specific interests. And then a neurotypical person will come in and is like, "No, I don't have a, what do you mean like that? What do you mean an internal monologue? I don't understand that." And just, it's fascinating to see, it just to recalibrate, to make sure that, oh yeah, that, yeah, because again, being autistic is so very normal, living in an autistic space, just to remind me that the majority of the world isn't like that, and that's why.
It's like it's frustrating sometimes when neurotypicals they're just like they try to say they say things like, oh, everyone's a little autistic, and
Yes, everyone has at least one train in their basement, you know. Everyone has written at least one book out of nowhere of something that they really, really love, as they do. No, they just don't get it.
they
They
don't get it.
but that's the thing about the hyperconnected brain, because a brain that has been pruned halfway through doesn't understand any of the intensity that we have. It doesn't understand the sensory intensity, the emotional intensity. It doesn't understand why we do what we do. So therefore, that's their best guess that, yes, I once looked at a train and I enjoyed it. I understand that everyone, they can't get it. And it's just a very big culture clash. It's a cross neurotype communication mismatch that I wish that they would be open to the idea that there's stuff that a person can't possibly know, because it's like a person who's blind from birth doesn't understand the concept of the color red, and this is just something that they can't get, and it bothers them, especially clinicians, man, because clinicians like to believe that they understand everything. And yeah, this is one of the biggest things about, being autistic in a clinician space, because one of the common things I hear is, and I don't know where they get this, but it's somebody must have said it, "I don't need to be depressed to diagnose depression, and I don't need to be autistic to diagnose autism." And well, the fact that you equate autism to depression is a sign that you just don't get it.
Yeah, and I see like I see a lot of people still referring to it as a disease. Like, I watched this thing on Netflix and a few months ago, and I only made it through 2 minutes because it was like it was something about gut health.
And oh God, yes. Yeah, talk about that, because that's a huge thing that I have many rants about. Yes, go on.
Yeah, well, I just I remember being interested in it. I was like, okay, because I've had, as an autistic person, I've had some gut issues, and I know a lot of us in the community tend to relate to that. So I was like, okay, I want to see, and it wasn't even, I didn't know it was gonna have anything to do with neurodiversity. Even I just thought it was gonna be about gut stuff, and I was interested, and then. I just remember, they're talking about diseases like Parkinson's, autism, and I'm like, okay.
Yes, yes. There is one woman in particular that is part of, there's this psychology symposium on PESI that talks about autism and really, really wants to be the be-all, end-all autism training, and it's not. And there's this one woman who claims that gut bacteria cause autism rather than genetics causing a hyperconnected brain, which causes us to have food sensitivities, which causes us to have a limited gut biome because of the food sensitivities, which changes our gut bacteria, because she doesn't understand correlation and causation. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing out there, because I don't and this leads to quacks out there, because there was a period right before the pandemic where people were trying to sell bleach enemas for children, because they're like, you could cure your child's autism by bleach up their butts. And that's horrifying. Yeah. Number one, that they would want to do this. Number two, that they would believe it. But number three, that they would just rather have a kid, because autism was presented as such a horrible, horrible thing, that it's better to cause such gastric distress than to just let them be who they are. And, you know, that's the thing with the myth about vaccines. They'd rather their kid die from polio than be autistic.
I know, that's what bothers me the most. And it's an example, I guess, of how there's so much misunderstanding about autism, even in progressive spaces, even in the pro-vaccine movement, people that are that know that, you know, this thing is a myth, they're still reinforcing the idea that autism is some sort of bad thing, you know. And then it's because I saw this guy, this comedian, this so-called progressive comedian that I used to follow just a couple days ago, I guess he's starting to get comments saying, he got a comment saying that he's clearly autistic, and I don't take that as an insult, and I didn't expect him to take it as an insult either, knowing his background and values and everything. But he goes on and posts this video of hateful comments like this, paid for my vacation or whatever, and then he's showing off his vacation. And I'm just what the hell? I think he's actually queer too. And I think he's a and I'm just what are you doing? I had to unfollow him right away. It's Walter Masterson, for whoever wants to go ahead and unfollow him as well. Cause I had, I never imagined something, but it's UCSF just put this article out about eugenics, I guess, I don't know, 8 or 9 months ago or something. So there's just so many, even in these, progressive spaces and, progressive cities, I see, and people, I'm just there's so much ableism still.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing that gets me, because there's... And this is the big this is actually why we created the Autistic Culture Podcast, because it seems like there is a massive propaganda machine out there that vilifies autism for the purposes of funding quote-unquote autism cures, like the ABA industry and anti-autism research, and this machine influences public perception because they're the ones that tell clinicians, oh yes, they're clearly inhuman in some way or another. And then, you know, it filters down into like the good doctor.
Oh my God, that's so Jesus. Doctor. Yeah.
And it's The Good Doctor is such a bizarre show. It's the same as having a white guy put on black face paint and pretend to be black. And it's so insulting. Every time I see a clip of it, it hurts me. Yeah. And well, there's all these weird assumptions about our lack of humanity and a lack of understanding. And like I was telling you earlier about, you know, the weird assumption from those doctors that, you know, we can't breed, that we can't, you know, have children, even a basic human assumption. It's bizarre. So we created the podcast to feature, you know, prominent people who have a lot of autistic traits, like, you know, Walt Disney or, you know, Jim Henson or, you know, our latest episode we just recorded yesterday is about Stephen Hillenbrand, who created SpongeBob, Tom Kenny, the voice, came out and said SpongeBob's autistic. Yeah. And I mean, honestly, Tom Kenny's probably autistic too. But, you know, Stephen Hillenbrand was a marine biologist before he became an animator. And he had so many autistic traits. And I didn't realize that ALS is much more common among autistic people than allistics. Mm. And he died of ALS. Mm. So we went through a whole deep dive about all of his special interests and why, you know, it's incredibly likely that autism is baked into SpongeBob's DNA. But I mean, that's the thing. There's so many aspects of our culture in general that can be directly attributed to autistic people. George Lucas, I mean, when we think about autistic, George Lucas is autistic to a T. His two directions were faster and more intense. He could write a script, not great with, you know, dealing with actors. But, you know, every actor that he got along well with, like, you know, Mark Hamill, probably one of us. But, you know, it's one of those things that we shape our culture. And instead of being valued for that, we're vilified for not doing the small talk and not making the eye contact and not making people feel comfortable on a one-on-one basis, despite changing the world and making the world a better place.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's still like, I mean, like you said, it's a machine, and I think it's so ingrained in people still, like that internalized ableism and just like the smallest things.
Oh, yeah.
And like people, like I have neurotypical friends that like try to understand, but I find myself not really hanging out with them as much because, they just don't, even when they're trying to understand, they're just things that they don't really get. And they'll still, like, you know, expect me to do something in a neurotypical way. Like, for example, there's this friend of mine who has known that I'm autistic, has actually been on my podcast before, but he still has, like, a lot of internalized ableism, and I worked on a project with him, and he basically, like, we agreed that I was gonna, so, like, we were gonna shoot this film of his at my place, and I was gonna get a co-producer credit, and I did, like, everything that we had agreed on, and then after the shoot, he comes and says, oh, well, it doesn't feel ethical to give you this credit, because I wasn't proactive enough, and then, like, do this.
What?
Like, he said I was apparently supposed to do more stuff as a co-producer, but he never told me what that was. And I was
supposed How can you do the things if you're not asked to do the things?
I was supposed to apparently figure it out and be proactive. Oh, and then, like, this other friend of mine who's also knows I'm autistic was saying, oh, well, he just thought you needed to, like, be more proactive. What do you fucking mean? Like, guess what he wants and just do something that he doesn't. But it's, like, so ingrained in neurotypical culture. And then it's, like, You know, like even stuff like stimming, like, oh, you can feel, like people will tell me I can unmask, but then I start stimming or I don't look them in the eye and they're like off put by it.
Yeah. I've been called out for rocking and swaying and tapping my pin and all of that stuff. And my last relationship actually ended because of stuff like that, because I was engaged to an ADHD woman who had an ADHD kid from a prior relationship. And we started talking about autistic pride, and the kid started talking about how proud he was to be autistic. And her mother, who is not autistic at least, took great offense to that. And she was like, "No, honey, you're not autistic. You're normal." And he was like, "No, I'm autistic." And I was like, "Yeah, high five, buddy." And it got to the point where she was very, very frustrated that I was, quote, pushing an agenda on the kid to be proud of being autistic instead of seeing it's a bad thing. And the family was very, very upset with me that I can't change. But they can't tell me what I need to change, but I can't change because I'm autistic. And I'll never change because I'm autistic, but they can't say what they do. Because, again, they don't understand clarity of speech. They don't understand how to communicate. And instead of just that, they have this implicit, ethereal belief of what is appropriate and what is inappropriate, but they're not able to communicate it. And that's somehow our fault. So, yeah. And it came to a head, and it was just like, yeah, all right. This can't work. So, it's very, very damaging to our relationships and to our mental health. Because, again, every time that something like that happens, you're like, well, I'm out. I'm just going to go live in a cave because, you know, all these people are being judged. This is where our rejection sensitivity, our perception sensitivity dysphoria comes from, because we go into a situation thinking, ah, yes, I will be clear and therefore I won't be misunderstood. I will be very clear and accurate and articulate. But that's not what they want. That's not what they get. They want you to be a mind reader. They expect us to be psychic. And when we don't live up to their unspoken, unidentified, undefined ideals, then they get mad at us for some reason.
Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah.
It's nonsense, man.
It's nonsense. Like, that's why I definitely gravitate more towards autistic spaces now. And then it's, like, hard because then it's, like, I mean, I have a lot of, you know, all of this, like, trauma from, like, all these interactions with neurotypicals with feeling, like, misunderstood. It feels like it makes me really angry at neurotypicals sometimes, and then it's hard because, like, I even worry, like, about, like, because then people get upset, like, if I'm too, like, harsh, but then it's, like, it also, like, I have to remind myself that I have a right to be, like, upset because of the experiences I've had. And, like, I try to not generalize too much, but I just know that it's, like, even the people that try to be the kindest and the most understanding, it's, there's always some little microaggression or some little thing.
There are. In the 60s, psychologists came up with a term for the black community called cultural paranoia, because black people tend not to trust white people for obvious reasons, because, you know, white people inevitably, you know, especially in the 60s, mistreat black people a whole lot. So black people are like, I don't know, that guy's white. He might do something bad to me. Native Americans don't trust white people because of, you know, horrible atrocities.
Yeah.
And it's the same way with us and neurotypicals. Mm-hmm. And neurotypicals take that personally. Holistics really, really have a lot of fragility around that.
They do.
Especially when we try to tell them that, you know, things, we have these experiences. Mm-hmm. And inevitably, what I've encountered, especially among holistic clinicians, are Well, not all of us do that. It's like, well, I'm not saying that all of you do that. I'm saying that it happens enough that we must be wary of it. But again, they take that as a personal attack.
Yeah.
And it's the holistic fragility is something else, man. It especially is. When you're trying to educate them about this experience. Or like ABA saying, yes, you see, that's a form of conditioning linked to gay conversion. And you're like, well, that's not how I use it. I use the good ABA. It's like, well, there is no good ABA. ABA, just like there's no good gay conversion, and they get all upset about that because you're coming at it from a different perspective, and they think that they understand, but they don't.
Yeah, no, it's really hard. The fragility is just really hard. Like, and then, like, you know, people are like, oh, well, it's just a misunderstanding. It's just because. I mean, there's a lot of it that's a misunderstanding, but it's also a machine and a system.
Yes, yes. You know? And that's the thing, because if it wasn't so profitable to misunderstand us, if the ABA industry wasn't like a $1.8 billion a year industry trying to quote-unquote fix us, then it would be more of a misunderstanding, but it's a deliberate misunderstanding on a systemic level that needs a lot of change and hurts a lot of us on a daily basis, especially when you get like the Judge Rodenberg Center involved, where they're, you know, deliberately administering electric shocks to autistic people because they don't think that we feel pain. I mean, that's more than a misunderstanding. That's causing a ton of harm under the pretense of they're doing what is best for us. It's a tough world out there. And I wish that, granted, there are a lot of, there are neurotypical people out there who want to understand us. And that's why with the Autistic Culture Podcast, I once wrote The Legend of Autistica, where Autismix, the creator of the autistic nation, led autistic people to freedom from the tyranny of neurotypicals.
Yeah.
And it's welcome. And I really do believe that, for instance, like, you know how, like, some stores like Walmart have quiet shopping hours?
Yeah.
I really, really believe that it would be beneficial for everybody to have quiet shopping hours. I really believe that it would be beneficial for everyone to have more comfortable clothes, to have more flexibility in work, to be able to work from home. And we're essentially the canaries in the coal mine when it comes to all these needs for accommodations. And I believe that neurotypical people would benefit from living more autistically if they weren't sold the lie of pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And I use the phrase, have you tried just suffering? Because that seems to be the motto of the neurotypical people. That they are sold this lie that in order to be a good and just person, you must suffer. And because we can't suffer as much as they do, well, we suffer more than they do, but we can't suffer as long as they do because we tend to exit the world early. They get mad at us for saying, hey, we would like to stop suffering, please. And it goes against neurotypical cultures based on suffering. And I wish that more people rebelled against that and wanted to live a happier, longer, more friendly life.
Yeah, exactly. Because I see this whole thing, this happening. I see it happen even with some neurodivergent people too, that are like, particularly those that are like really high masking or very late diagnosed, and they're like, oh, because I had to suffer, so then you have to suffer too. And it really should be like no one should have had to suffer in the first place. Like, I have people like, you know, because people will be like this one person that I would have discussions with sometimes, and of course I believe they're very likely neurotypical, and they were like telling me, oh, well, people can be upset because like they had to suffer, but I'm like, well, then be upset at the system. Don't be upset at people who aren't suffering now, like, because, or not as much, because they have a little more support, which is still not enough. But I'm like, I don't, when I think of like a autistic kid in school now that maybe has more accommodations than I did, I'm happy for them. I'm like, yes. Okay, I'm good. Yes. That's good. I didn't have that, but I'm glad they do. It's like, it needs to be like a shift of the mindset.
It does.
Yeah.
Because that's the whole point of society. In theory, every generation is more refined than the generation who came before it. In theory, every generation should suffer less from the advances of the generation before it. Because again, we don't have to go down to the stream and slap our laundry against rocks because we have, you know, washing machines. We don't have to go out and hunt wild boars because we have supermarkets. In theory, we should be working to make the next generation's life easier. And that's why I'm an outspoken advocate. And that's why I'm do my best to be a public figure for advocacy. Because as soon when my son was born, my son was born fairly early, and it was touch and go for a long time. But when he came home, it was really obvious from like the day he was born that he was one of us. He loved looking at lights. He loved looking at fans. I was like, he cannot go through the same stuff that I did. Mm-hmm. So that became my new life mission, to change the world to make life easier for his generation, because I don't want him to suffer like I did.
Yeah.
And I will stand up. I will take all of the I will take all of the verbal abuse. I will take all of the criticism. I will take all of the stuff to protect him from being hurt in the future. Because if I can stand up and be belligerent and change people's minds now, hopefully he won't have nearly as much ableism to deal with when he gets to be my age. Hopefully he will vastly have a longer lifespan than I will, because he won't be nearly as stressed as I am.
Yeah, exactly. No, I think that's the goal for sure. Is that we continue to challenge the pathology paradigm and like get people to start seeing more of the neurodiversity paradigm and more deep down too, because I also see people that they'll start using certain terms, like neurodiversity terms, but they'll still like pathologize it or like.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, like, you know, when my ex put my son into ABA without me knowing, his ABA person was saying, "Oh, it's neurodiversity affirming ABA." That's an antonym. It's meaningless. It's like the word organic now, that it has absolutely no meaning. Mm-hmm. This is why when I created a modality of therapy called autistic-centered therapy that is focused on the needs of autistic people communicating in autistic ways and healing autistic trauma. And I'm very, very protective of it, because I don't want someone to misappropriate that and to claim it for themselves and do bad with the thing that I created. Mm-hmm. So I am very, very protective, and we're going to be doing trainings and certification, not because I want to gatekeep. Well, yes. I don't want to gatekeep from the people who want to help autistic people in autistic affirming ways, but I do want to gatekeep from the people who would exploit it and use the term in a misleading or predatory way, so that they can, you know, take it upon themselves just to claim it, because it's very, very damaging. You don't know who you can trust anymore.
Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah. I know this is going back a little bit, but you mentioned that your partner was not autistic. So I was kind of curious what dating was like for you, particularly with a non-autistic person, because I know that's a big thing for a lot of us, is navigating the neurotypical dating world.
In the beginning, we met online, and I didn't know until a year or two into it that she lied on her dating profile, and she said, "Oh yes, I put down all the answers. It was like I was shopping for a boyfriend, and I put down all the answers that I would like to have in a boyfriend instead of who she actually was." Uh-huh. So, you know, when I came out and I was like, yes, I really like Star Wars and I like this and I like this. And she was, oh, that's cool. And then, you know, as we got along into it, turns out she hated Star Wars. And it turns out that everything was very, very, but again, by that time, I was deeply brainwashed into the neurotypical relationship paradigm of, yes, two people find each other and they don't like each other, but they stay together anyway for the purposes of breeding. And because, you know, that's what neurotypicals seemed to do. And when we hung out with her neurotypical friends, they would all talk about their beverages of choice and where to go eat. Even if we were eating out, they would talk about where they would go eat next. And, you know, no, nothing of substance. For instance, like I would want to talk about the, at the time, like DARPA was working on a Predator suit that had like, you know, the light cloaking stuff. And it was really neat because in order to have a cloak, you would have to either make light move faster because, you know, it would refract through it and you'd have to go from one side to the other or bend light slower around it. And the calculations of that were intense. And when I was like, yeah, that's really neat, just met with complete blank stares. Nobody knew what to say. They wanted to talk about what beer they were
I
drinking.
know, yeah.
And like, oh, yeah, I'll just, yeah, this is. And again, that led to a lot of conflict with her and her friends because her friends didn't like me, her family didn't like me. I was always too weird for them. And they were like, I don't understand why you like to be with him because he's so weird. And, you know, in the end, I really wish that I had found. I mean, I'm glad I got my son out of it, but yeah, the whole experience was just, looking back, very unpleasant, and it was unfortunate.
Yeah, well, I wanted to, yeah, I wanted, I know we touched a little bit on this already, but what would you say are like the main issues that you see with parents when they come, when they like bring their kid in for an evaluation, and like, what are some of the things that have maybe even helped them change, like the ones that are willing to change their perspective? What has helped them, like something that you discussed with them, maybe?
Well, they usually fall into one of three camps. One is that it's the neurotypical parent because there's likely one or two autistic parents that bring the kid in. Or if the kid is adopted, then they're adopted by well-meaning neurotypicals. But the neurotypical is looking for a way to solve the problem of autism. And we have to say, no, it's not a problem to be solved, it's a thing to be understood. Number two, there's an autistic parent bringing their autistic child in. The autistic parent says, yes, I had problems with us. I had problems with this. I had problems with this. They may not realize that they're autistic and they have a high degree of internalized ableism that we have to deal with in order to, you know, overcome this. Or number three, that they're autistic and they're suspecting or they come to realize in the middle of the evaluation that they're autistic, and then they burst into tears because I'm talking about things in an autistic affirming way and say, yes, this is just the way. This is how our people do things. I talk about autistic culture, and they're like, oh my God, I wish I'd had this when I was their age. And then all of a sudden, they're all in, and they realize that they have to embrace themselves in order to embrace their kid, which leads into a whole new journey of self-discovery and, you know, processing trauma because they've dealt with a whole bunch of trauma throughout their life that was unrecognized and, you know, and they're unconsciously pushing their children in that because they think that their children are inevitably going to be damaged in the same way. So it's a healing journey for the parent and child. So that's the ideal. But again, dealing with the internalized ableism and especially dealing with the ones who every once in a while, like one time, there was a neurotypical relative of a client that got really, really mad when the client asked me to bring the neurotypical relative in, trying to explain the autism. And the neurotypical relative was like, "I don't know why I'm listening to you. You don't even have empathy. I don't understand why how they let you have a degree because you can't empathize with people." And I was like, "Oh man, so I'm going to give you some reading about Milton's double empathy problem."
Yeah.
And yeah, and it's I face a lot of ableism from clients like that. But again, you know, when working with autistic adults, autistic families of autistic kids, it's the reason why I'm able to keep going. But I can only work 4 days a week because of, you know, negative interactions, because it causes me to crash and burn. It just drains me. So you know, on Fridays, I sleep until like noon because I just my body gives out on me. I just don't have that much energy to keep facing the battles day in and day out without crashing. So.
Yeah, I relate to the whole empathy thing, like the misunderstanding that neurotypicals have towards autistic empathy, and
Oh, yeah.
how, because I've always thought about it, and I've heard other people talk about it too, about how I actually feel a lot of times I feel hyper empathy,
We
and it,
do. We do.
yeah.
And studies have actually validated that. And a lot of it is because, every brain has this thing called mirror neurons, right? It's the reason why if somebody yawns, another person will yawn. And our mirror neurons are hyper-connected and hyper-dense, which is the reason why we accidentally copy people's accents, we accidentally copy people's mannerisms, and when something hits us, it hits us super, super hard because we hyper-empathize with people. But it's not the same sort of empathy that neurotypical people have. I always explain it as if someone was coming into my office and they stubbed their toe on my desk, a neurotypical person would say, "Oh my, that must hurt." But an autistic person might say, "You should watch out for that desk next time so you won't get hurt." But you know, it's when it comes to especially like animals or something, oh God, it rips us apart.
Oh my
But
goodness, yeah.
with fictional characters, man, we get so deep into that. We feel the pain of our favorite fictional characters. And that's due to our neurology. And we do have this hyperempathy. It's just not what neurotypicals are accustomed to. We don't do that performative empathy that they do.
Exactly. And then that's it. I feel like that's the part that gets, that causes me to be misunderstood so much, is like I won't have that outward expression of it. I'm like, oh my God, I'm really sorry. Like, gosh, you know, but I'll be feeling that in my head.
Yeah, it might cause a shutdown.
It might
You
cause a
might be
shutdown.
feeling, yeah, you might be feeling something so hard you shut down, your face goes blank, and you retreat inward instead of saying, "Oh, thoughts and prayers," because we don't do that performative stuff. We just it hits us like a rock.
And then it's like exactly what you said, like the shutdown. It's like I'm so overwhelmed by this empathy and by these emotions that I can't say anything or do anything because I'm like it's shutting me down.
Yes. Yeah, the shutdowns are, and this is another thing that neurotypicals don't understand. They take it as us being defensive. They take us as us being rude. They don't see it as a circuit breaker going off, and we just can't function anymore because we're dealing with so much internal stuff. They think that it's intentional. They think that it's a behavioral choice when actually we just get hit with a rock and we stop functioning.
I think we might have touched a little bit on microaggressions, but I wanted to open it up more to like more stories of like common microaggressions that you get.
Well, so I'm on the Kentucky Autism Council that has the Kentucky autism, the Kentucky Advisory Council on Autism, that has the unfortunate acronym CACA.
Mm.
And they did not consult an autistic person on that. So the majority of the council are neurotypicals who, quote, work with autistic children. And we finally got a whole bunch of autistic people on the council. But one person in particular complained that there are, quote, too many autistic people or too many people with autism on the council. And I was like, well, that's the thing about it. You need to have autistic voices to understand autistic problems. And she's like, well, Matt, I don't need to know what autistic people are thinking to be able to advocate for them. And I was like, well, it's sort of like having the NAACP, but only having white people in there. And she said, and I quote, Matt, I think the black people would be better off if white people spoke for them, don't you?
Oh, my gosh.
And I'm like, oh, my. I didn't realize we were overtly racist. Oh. And this sort of woman just chimes in every damn time complaining about our wants, our needs. We had a meeting about autistic suicidality, and there was one woman who got a grant, and she's like, well, it's because autistic people don't understand friends. If they had friends, we should teach people how to have friends, and they won't be suicidal. And I interrupted her, and I was like, no, it's the ableism. It's the, you know, internalized ableism. It's the hopelessness. It's this, it's this, it's this. And then she got very upset that I was correcting her about the autistic experience because, you know, I've been there, and she hasn't. So this is a big thing we're working on at Trailhouse now, to actually legit study autistic suicidality from autistic internalized perspectives. But again, they get very angry about this.
Yeah.
But the biggest one is like on the council, right? Mm-hmm. They said that I am not allowed to say that I'm on the council when I do my stuff like my podcast. But a neurotypical person on the council is able to say if they're on the council and advertise their position on the council when they promote ABA.
Wow.
Yeah, because there is a massive, massive double standard about what they consider appropriate because, again, they're all about the neurotypical perspective of autistic people, not autistic, not actually autistic understanding. And it's that where they believe that they have the authority to control our narratives. I say that that's the biggest microaggression because they don't see that they're doing anything wrong with it. They think that they have years of expertise studying us. But again, it doesn't change the fact that we have years being us.
Yeah.
And I tell a lot of people, one of the topics that we recently covered on the podcast a little bit, I have on my bookshelf over here, I've got maybe four or five really good books about autism written by autistic people. I've got around 107 bad books about autism written by neurotypical people. And we were talking about how it's very, very difficult for autistic people to become professionals due to the gauntlet of ableism that you must persevere through. And for instance, like, we're all required to take behaviorism courses and to write papers that the professor approves of, saying, yes, that ABA is certainly good for fixing autism and all this other stuff, because if we go against it, they consider it a personal attack rather than a disagreement with the conclusions that they present. Because again, it's all about the top-down social hierarchy versus the bottom-up data processing that we do. Mm. And I say that the top-down social hierarchy is the number one source of the microaggressions out there because we are data-driven people, because we are more equitable, and we will talk to anybody from any position in life, from any walk of life. Rather than saying, oh, yes, that person has a degree, we should absolutely listen to them, and everything that they say is the absolute end-all be-all. Neurotypicals love that top-down social hierarchy, and they get very offended if we don't follow that. So we live in a world that is inherently built against our operating system, and that's where every microaggression comes from. They get very upset that we break this expectation day in and day out, and they want us to conform to this unspoken rule that they've conformed to. And when we don't, they push back hard. And it's snide remarks, it's exclusion, it's talking about us behind our backs, it's using autism as a pejorative term. It's everybody's a little autistic, discounting our experiences. And it's hurtful in many, many, many ways, which is again where the shutdowns and the meltdowns and the daily difficulty comes from. Because if we lived in the land of Autistica where we didn't have to deal with any of this stuff, we wouldn't be nearly as disabled. We're very disabled from a social model because it's exhausting existing in this space that was not built for us. But if we lived in a world where, again, me, I largely do therapy from my house. I am sitting here in cotton shorts and bare feet, in the dark, surrounded by books and a good beverage and all the things that I love. It gives me the strength to do as much work as I do, but I'm very cognizant that so many autistics out there are forced to push through the point of burnout, working day in and day out in environments that are incredibly hurtful. And just not acknowledging our sensory needs or our social needs or making us make eye contact on a day-to-day basis, it kills us.
Yeah, that's what it's really saddening to see that, like, even though I've been lucky to like be working with stuff in my own way and like have my own like structure as well, I know that there's so many people that don't. And then like to have to see like people go through, like even like friends of mine and like people that I've been in support groups with, like to see that they have to just push through like so hard. And then I see how like how that ties in also to like people having people blaming themselves for being autistic instead of the system. 'Cause it's like I just found that it's like hard to get most people to, like you were mentioning earlier, to like see the bigger picture, like with this whole systemic issue and the ABA machine and everything.
And it's the same machine that marginalizes people of many different backgrounds, whether it be sexuality or gender or race or anything. Because I am remarkably privileged as an autistic middle-aged cishet white guy. I can't imagine the difficulty that a black trans woman would have to deal with, because I mean, there are multiple intersections of marginalization when it comes to all these differences of identity, because it all comes down to colonialism and conformity. Because there is one group that says that the way that they do things is absolutely correct, and every other deviation must be punched back into place. And that's why I have the obligation, yet privilege, to be able to speak out, because I know that because I'm a cishet white dude who's of middle age, I'll get less pushback, especially on like the council, than someone who is more marginalized than me. Because again, we live in a world that is very, very disdainful of differences. And it's very, very saddening. But that's another thing. Whenever we do have the opportunity, I want to elevate voices of other marginalized groups, because we absolutely, this is one thing about the council, because the woman who is incredibly racist, that happened to be the day when I invited a black autistic guy on, and he was horrified. He never came back with I understand why, and it's very unfortunate. We had one person who really wanted to be on the podcast, and she was autistic. She did a great service. I won't say what it is because I don't want to single her out, because it was a service that I loved, that I really wanted to talk about, and I would promote the living crap out of, but she was terrified to come out as autistic because she is from a marginalized background, and she was afraid that people would judge her and attack her for that. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I really want to elevate your voice. I really, really, really want to talk about this thing that you do. At the same time, because it's the Autistic Culture Podcast, this, the whole purpose of this is to elevate autistic voices and to promote an autistic identity. And we can't do that because it's unsafe for you to do so. And I respect her decision. I respect her needs. I respect that she needs to be safe above all else. It's unfortunate we live in a society that's systemically biased against those differences. And if this woman ever gets to the point where she wants to come out, again, the offer is always still there because she does something really, really cool. And I would love to talk to her about it and love to praise her and, you know, advertise her services to the autistic community and to the neurotypical community, anyone who will listen, because she does really, really awesome stuff. But it's, I understand the multiply marginalized people out there live in such a dangerous situation that masking is all that they can do to survive. And this is why ABA is so predatory for black kids, because they advertise that black autistic kids are very likely to be executed by, you know, corrupt police officers. Mm-hmm. And that is sad, that is accurate, and we need to reform that rather than forcing black kids to, you know, mask. But again, we live in a society where safety is mm-hmm. paramount, and I understand the need for parents to maintain safety for their children. So I can't criticize the actions of the parents for wanting to protect their kids. I criticize the industry for profiting off of ableism and discrimination.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true. It's hard because, I also understand, you know, like, the... especially in the case of an autistic person that's multiply marginalized, how they have to mask in order to stay safe. But then, you know, how there is, it's important, of course, to stay safe, but there's also, it's just the same cycle because the system doesn't, unless the system changes.
This is why we do advocacy work, because we need the voices out there to demand change. We need people to have the safety to stand up and say, you are not alone. We are numerous. We were out here because the CDC says that 1 in 20 kids is going to be diagnosed with autism. But because we've got this 94% heritability rate, that doesn't account for the siblings of the autistic kids that may not be diagnosed. Doesn't account for the parents or the grandparents or the aunts and uncles or the other people. So we might be as high as 20% of the population, which is a significant portion of the population. And if we stood up to be counted and to be acknowledged, we could together make a systemic difference. It's that systemic bias that makes us all fearful of coming out, and we're all living and hiding together. But if we came out, we were able to make systemic change, we can make the world better for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So there's one, this has been a really great episode, that there's one more question that I wanted to ask you. How do you cope with burnout, shutdowns, and meltdowns?
Oh man. So I pretty much, Mondays and Tuesdays are my client days, and I deal with a lot of people who have a lot of trauma. So after I see clients, I eat and go to bed immediately. So I go to bed at 7 so that I can just recharge. Meltdowns are more along the lines if I'm overstimulated. Like I absolutely will not go out to Walmart on a Saturday afternoon. That's just not going to happen. Because if I'm stuck out there, I will, be overstimulated, and that's where the meltdowns come from. So I always carry loop earbuds on me just in case. I go out at odd times so I don't have to deal with that much, that much social interaction. I drive when there aren't as many cars on the road. I limit my stimuli. Again, right now I'm sitting here in the dark with no shoes and socks on. I have a sensory diet to make sure that I am not overstimulated that leads to the meltdowns. We recently went to a Disney World, and at night it's fantastic because there's fewer crowds, there's lots of elbow room, but at noon, especially on a weekend, it really, really destroyed me. So I have to be very cognizant about how much stimulation I have. The burnout, man. Oh God, the burnout is a whole thing. The last time I hit major burn, well, I take it back. 2017 was a gigantic burnout. That it was right after my divorce from my child's mother, and it took months and months and months. It may be 9 or 10 months for me to recover from that. And 1 month of that, I had to take an entire month off of work. I had a lot of sick leave built up, and I was able to handle it. But it took a very, very long time to get through that. The pandemic was a whole other thing because I started up my practice in 2018, and I was working and working and working, maybe 60-hour weeks for the first 2 years, trying to get off the ground. And then the pandemic happened right when I hit burnout. So I had several months of government-sponsored time off, and during that period, we were granted exactly one out-of-state session to accommodate for people who were quarantined in place. And thanks to that, a whole bunch of people from across the U.S. Came to me, and I hit TikTok, and people were very, very they liked me a lot and praised me a lot, and that's what got my business really started. But yeah, the pandemic was a gigantic burnout period for me there too. And since then, I can only work about 4, maybe 3.5 days a week, because otherwise, I know that if I work a full 5-day week, I will hit burnout again. I realize if I work more than maybe 20 hours a week, I will hit burnout. So it takes, and that's the thing, that as we get older, our meat bodies are less able to handle stress because every time we hit burnout, it chips away a bigger and bigger chunk of us. And this leads into a lot of epigenetic issues like POTS and mast cell activation syndrome and all sorts of other stuff that's linked to all this. And I realized that my cortisol level is really, really high and doing all sorts of damage anyway. And I have to be very, very cognizant of that so that it doesn't destroy me. It's something that the neurotypical world doesn't have to worry about because of their lack of stress response, because their lack of sensory response and, being overstimulated, they don't have to deal with any of this stuff. They don't even know it exists. But we must be very cognizant of our stress levels so that our meat bodies don't just disintegrate.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, it's a tricky thing, and it involves a lot of deliberate self-care. I have to deliberately say, I am going to get a lot of sleep today. I will. I feel bad because I get a lot of emails saying, "Hi, I would like to know more about this." And it's they're very, very thoughtful, and they write very nice long emails. And I'm like, I don't have the energy to respond to that. I'll get back to it, and before I know it, it's 3 months later. And I feel bad about it. At the same time, I recognize that I just don't have the energy to do that and also live. So I want to be an example for, because otherwise I'm a hypocrite. Because I tell people to take care of themselves, I tell my clients go do self-care, and if I don't do the self-care, then I'm a massive hypocrite and I can't do that because of the autism. But you know, it's one of those things. It's a toughie.
Yeah, certainly. I also sometimes don't take my own advice sometimes of like being kinder to myself, like, 'cause I feel like I'm still really hard on myself when I like not just with autism stuff, but with ADHD too, like with just like forgetting something or like forgetting why I came to a room. And then I'll like blame myself for it. And then I have to remind myself of what I advocate for and of like being accepting and accommodating of it and not blaming myself. So yeah, I've definitely, I feel that kind of struggle sometimes and of like the process of unlearning all the internalized ableism that is constantly being pumped out by the machine. And then also like now, like not like knowing of that machine and then catching that machine. And I think that's the disconnect with neurotypicals too, is a lot of the neurotypicals, like you said, they're not even aware. I mean, they're not even aware of like the sensory stuff, and they're not even aware of this ableism machine and how ingrained it is. So it's like all of that.
Because again, like, you know, with the ADHD stuff, they just say, ah, have you had better morals? Because it's for some reason a moral failing to forget things or to not do your laundry or, you know, whatever executive functioning stuff might pop up. They just, again, it's that Puritan work ethic of you just need to work harder, get your bootstraps, et cetera, et cetera. It's insane. I don't get it.
Me neither, yeah. Anyways, this I think those are all the questions I have, but I just wanted to thank you again for coming on. This was a really great episode. And I will put the links below for your podcast. And I believe you have a website as well.
I do.
Cool.
MattLowryLPP.com.
Cool. I'll put
I don't
the
update it nearly as much as I should due to, you know, executive functioning and all, but I've got some neat stuff on there. I recently came up with the concept that neurotypicals suffer from PDC, pathological demand compliance, because they're like, hey, do this thing, and then they do the thing, and then they get mad when we don't do the thing. So I think that we should really turn that on its head and focus on pathological demand compliance. So I'm going to write something up about that
Oh, I
because
really
I
like
want everyone to
that.
start using that term.
That's a really good one because, yeah, like I've always felt that like criticism also of like being like really you know wanting to do things my own way and like not complying with like neurotypical molds or constructs or and then yeah like being viewed as the problem and you know this whole culture of like compliance over consent
Yes. Yeah.
changing that.
Yeah, that's the thing. We need to change the way we view these things.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I wanted to I'm always a little awkward with goodbyes, but
This is the way.
yeah. Thanks for coming on. Thank you everyone for listening. See you all next time.